This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hi, this is Tony Gilkison, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcasts.
Pantheon Podcasts presents, from Hollywood, California, The Devil's Music with Pleasant Gaiman. You are invited to join the Hollywood princess as she explores her lifelong pursuits in the occult, sex, love, and that sinful rock and roll. Ladies and gentlemen, step into the dark parlor of Pleasant Gaiman as she brings you The Devil's Music.
Hey there, this is Pleasant Gaiman, and you're listening to The Devil's Music, a Pantheon podcast. A little bit about me. I'm a punk rock witch from Hollywood, California. I've had a lifelong passion for rock and roll and the occult that started when I was a preteen. In the 70s, I was one of the first punks in LA, and as a teenager, I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go, started producing shows, and made a Xerox fanzine called Lobotomy, which led me to write for every major rock publication you could think of. In the 80s and the 90s, I fronted 3 bands. I'm a best-selling author with 8 books out and more on the way. For the past 30 years, I've toured around the globe to teach and perform dance. You might have also seen me acting or dancing in music videos, feature films, and documentaries. Look for me in the new Go-Go's documentary. To find out more about me or to book a tarot reading, go to my website, pleasantgaiman.com. I'm really excited to be part of the Pantheon Podcasts network of rock and roll shows. Everyone here at Pantheon tells stories about the music we just adore so much, each and every one with a different twist. Find them all wherever you listen to podcasts, at Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Pandora, anywhere you get your favorite podcast fix. And head on over to pantheonpodcast.com to share a show with a friend. Or be damned to purgatory forever. Hi, this is Pleasant Gaiman. Today, my guest on The Devil's Music is the infamous and amazing punk legend and author, Patrick O'Neill. He's written a few memoirs. One is called Gun, Needle, and Spoon. The other one's called Hold Up. And his latest, out now on Punk Hostage Press, is called Anarchy at the Circle K. On the Road with the Dead Kennedys, TSOL, Flipper, and the Subhumans. I cannot wait to talk to Patrick. You guys are going to love him. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Pleasant. Thanks for having me.
You are so welcome. So I cannot put your new book down at all. I'm like addicted to it. It's so good. And even if I wouldn't have had a very similar history to you, I wouldn't be able to stop reading it. Also, I got to say that my producers on this podcast used to ask me if the guests taking a lot of acid was a prerequisite. Because that was just a coincidence with a lot of people I had. Like, obviously, my friends and I did it, but sometimes there would be a complete stranger that would talk about taking acid. But now you're the second bank robber, like rock and roll bank robber I'm having on. Because Jeff Drake from the Joneses robbed a bank too. I don't know if you know about that.
I do not know about that. It's very cool. I'm a good company then. That's cool.
I'm happy to have the rock and roll podcast that's inadvertently about crime.
Right. Well, we're all sort of on the edge anyway, right? We're sort of.
So why don't we sort of start with how before you started going on the road all the time and being a roadie and a bank robber and heroin addict and stuff. Let's talk about how you got into punk rock specifically.
Okay, well, I was a 17-year-old graphic artist. I was a cartoonist, and I was the youngest Polish cartoonist in America. And I got a free ride to the Samskar Art Institute as a printmaker. It was kind of weird. And then my work evolved into being a filmmaker finally in 4 years. But besides all that, what was going on at the Samskar Art Institute with all the bands were starting out of there. And the San Francisco bands like the Avengers and the Nuns and the Mutants were coming out of there. And it was sort of happening, it was happening in juxtaposition to all the big hair bands were going on. They had these things in Oakland called Day on the Green with, you know, huge bands and, stuff like, Journey and Yes, and those kind of bands would be playing. And it'd be so impersonal. And I just had lost interest in rock and roll. And I was a long-haired rock and roller, so like that. And I went down to the club, the Mabuhay Gardens, and saw DOA from Canada. And they blew my mind. There was like three of them up on stage just, you know, going at it. And you know, right after that, I saw the Ramones. And at that point, which is in the early 70s, late 70s, I cut my hair off. And I just started hanging out with the punk rock scene. And eventually, I was down at the club every night. And Got to know everybody there. Got to know the bartenders first, of course, and then hung out and sort of started working the club. Started working the club there, and then eventually got offered jobs to go on tour. And that's how one of my best friends was Chris Grayson, who was the sound man at the Mabuhay. And
yes. I didn't realize Chris was at the Mabuhay. I met him when my band, The Screaming Sirens, was touring a lot with TSOL. We used to call him Chris Crazy.
Yeah.
Because that's what, he was crazy, but one of the girls thought that was his name when she asked him, when she thought Grayson was crazy, but that's how crazy we were.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris was the first one of us that sort of made it out of the Mabuhay. Because he started doing sound for Dead Kennedys, they did sound for TSOL and a few other bands. He helped record the first Ripper album. I mean, he was the engineer on the recordist for the first album and stuff like that. So he was the one sort of making moves out of there first, and I sort of followed his footsteps.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people that are listening weren't old enough to experience that early punk scene. And like, it didn't even matter if you were in a band, kind of, you know, everyone, it was very, very inclusive in the beginning. I think, you know, like just, this is something that a lot of people don't know. And also about how all the bands knew each other and helped each other and, you know, would go on tour using one set of equipment or whatever. And, you know, not all the time, but.
Absolutely. You know, what my first band was a concept noise band, and you know, it was pretty horrible. But what our big thing would do is we go get a show, we start playing, And then we invite people up out of the audience to play our instruments, you know, like other musicians we know. And they'd get up and play our instruments. And they'd be playing this music. And we'd be in the bar drinking for free, watching the band get, we finally got paid for that. We barely even played. That was the whole concept. The whole concept was to pull people out of the audience to play for our instruments in, and then we could drink for free. That was my first band.
we did shit like that in the Scream and Sirens a lot too. Like we would have people up on stage, and one night in Canada, there was this girl that was being really wild in the audience, and we made her come up for, we were doing an encore of Honky Tonk Women. And also this guy had been sending trays and trays of shots, like, you know, up to the stage the whole time. And so she was, this girl was, we just strapped the guitar on her and she was just like making absolute noise with it, nothing that had anything to do. She was playing it, but she seemed like she was having fun. And after the set was over, I was like talking to her, and I was like, wow, you did really, really, you know, you did pretty good. Are you in a band? Did you want to be in a band? And then she goes, no, honey, you know that guy that's been sending you shots all night? And I said, yeah. And she was like, he wanted to come and see you. I'm a hooker. He's my John. I'm only a hooker. I don't want to be in a band.
Nice.
I know, that was a first.
Always the best, all the best people in our crowds.
Totally. Like, so when you were working at the MAB and stuff, when was your first tour with the Dead Kennedys, or how did you start touring?
Well, I would do local shows with the Kennedys. I got hired on. There was a road manager at that time was Microwave, and he hired me on just to load gear. That's basically, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know how to tune a guitar at that point. And he hired me on, so I do local shows, and we go up and down the coast. I'd be down to LA and like that. My first cross country tour was '84, with the Kennedys, and that's the first one I went out on. We went all the way to the that was during kind of like the Rock Against the World. No, it was '83. Sorry, '83, '82, '83, something like that. I'm my mind's, you know, I can't remember dates. We went cross country with the Kennedys to go do the Rock Against Reagan tours. So that would have to be '83.
Oh yeah, I remember Rock Against Reagan. That was yeah. So what was this is gonna open up an entire can of worms. What was the wildest on tour experience with the Dead Kennedys? And then I'm gonna ask you with every band, I guess, because this is okay. A lot of what your book's about. Also, I gotta say, for you guys listening, you got to remember that in these days when we were touring, there was no cell phones, no GPS. You had to go to a phone booth to call the club to get fucking directions if you didn't have like a paper map or a Thomas guide. And, you know, you'd be like in the middle of Arkansas or somewhere and not know where the fuck you were. Or
pretty much.
But always, if you look for Skid Row, though, that was usually where the club was near. That was our MO when we were totally lost. We'd be like, where's the worst section of town? And the club was there like almost every time.
Find the Greyhound bus station. You know, it's right by there, you know. With the Kennedys, there was a whole faction of people that hated the Kennedys and just paid money to come down and fuck with Biafra. And so it'd be like these huge shows where they would turn into riots. I mean, there was like in the early days, it was like riots every night with those guys. And, you know, it was get to be a little, you know, worried about the cops and, you know, then worry about skinheads. And it was pretty insane. So like it shows like in outside of Philadelphia, a total Irish neighborhood. We did a show there, and they got upset about the name. It was on the marquee, and all these Irish people got upset about the name. Came down and rioted, like they broke in, like smashing the windows of the club. We had to get the hell out of there. We just loaded the gear and got that out of there. It was like crazy, you know. And then the big shows here in LA, the cops would just come in and you know swoop in and do crazy shit. 1984 was it was the night with it was at the Starlight roller rink. It was Dead Kennedys. It was TSOL, Butthole Surfers, and Dead Kennedys coming in on New Year's Eve. And afterwards, there was just cops everywhere. It was like walking through a total like they're just looking at everything, trying to bust us and stuff like that. So that was the thing with the Kennedys. I mean, it was also the size of the shows. You know, there was always like huge jocks and you know, football type guys trying to kick our ass and things like that. It was pretty interesting because, you know, I mean, like you said, this is early punk rock. This isn't like, you know, where everybody knows, oh, look at Green Day. Green Day's so cool. This is like early days, like you were a freak. People looked at you like, what the hell is this, man? Who's that kid with the spiky hair out here in the middle of nowhere? You know, that's what we were dealing with, especially with the Kennedy. And, you know, and then the Kennedy's name on top of it really didn't help out a lot either.
Yeah, I never even thought about the name thing with the dead Kennedys. I mean, that makes total sense now. But that the names of so many bands were so weird in those days, or just, you know, weird compared to, like, I don't know, you know, regular band names.
Regular names. I there was a band called Dayglo Abortions.
I remember Dayglo.
Yeah. And some anti-abortion group came down and picketed their show. I'm like really? You know, that's crazy, you know?
Oh my God. What was the druggiest tour you were on?
The Kennedys didn't do drugs. It was just the road crew that did drugs, and it was specifically just me that did a lot of drugs. But then later on, the road crew was pretty much there. So that was a non-drug tour. But I mean, it would have to be a toss-up between Flipper and TSOL. And when TSOL was its heyday, I think we were all strung out. And then Flipper was half speed freaks, half heroin addicts.
Oh, so my God.
A little tough in the van at night.
Yeah, we had a rule in my band that if someone was going to take something, there had to be enough for the whole band so we'd all be able to play as a cohesive unit.
Ooh, that and, I don't think I ever.
We were all like, you know, poly substance abusers, so that wasn't hard. We took drugs all the time, but nobody was addicted. I mean, I'm saying that loosely. Like some people would say that we were all addicted, but.
Right.
You know, like you couldn't have like the drummer on speed and then the guitarist on mushrooms or something.
Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't work out.
That could be why Flipper sound like shit half the time. You know.
let's have a break and we'll go down another. We'll go down this spiral a little bit longer. So I guess we'll listen to the Dead Kennedys now, and then we can listen to Flipper in a little while. Okay, I'm back with Patrick O'Neill, and we're talking about drugs and touring now.
Go hand in hand. They're like one of them. At least when I was doing it, it was pretty much, you know, you and I were talking about this earlier. We were talking about how crazy it was, the idea that we would just go out into the world and there would be thinking there was a show there for one, that some kid was going to have a show somewhere. And the other one is like, I don't know, for me, I was like, I'd be strung out and I'd be leave like the coast. I'd be leave San Francisco. I'd leave LA. I'd leave New York and expect to score drugs out there. And I don't think I could do that these days. You know, not that I do drugs anymore these days, but like, you know, I don't know. I think we had a lot of balls in those days, and we were pretty fearless, all of us. You know, we just go. The fact that we just left the coast for one and just go into the middle of America was insane. But then to go in there, the middle of America strung out on drugs was also another insane thing. You know, I can remember scoring heroin in a biker bar in Norman, Oklahoma, and thinking, I'm going to fucking die in here. Okay. I'm going to die in here for a $20 bag. But no, got to do it. Things you got to do.
Yeah, my band had it easier because, I mean, because we were all girls when we were touring.
Yeah.
And people would drive from long distances to bring us drugs. Like, even,
nice.
I mean, we didn't even ask for it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember one time someone was like, gave like a whole like quart-sized TSA now baggie, but it was full of white powder. And I thought it was coke. And they're like, no, this is a new drug called ecstasy. I mean, that was fucking amazing. We didn't take it right on the spot, but then we realized we didn't get any instructions on it. We're sitting in the van going, do you snort it? Should we put some alcohol? Like, you can't eat the powder, right? Like, we didn't know what to do, but so we were just trying, multiple choice buffet of how to take it. It's not so fucking waste.
I like how the drugs didn't come with instructions. They're just a baggie.
Because it was a new drug, but also I had no, that was when I think that was in the window of time, maybe when it was legal or it hadn't been made illegal.
Sure, yeah.
But then we found out there was a, in Oakland, there was this place that had been a pizza factory. Mm-hmm. That was now like an ecstasy lab, and there was like whitish powder all over the floor, and I thought it was leftover like wheat flour, and someone's like, no, that's E.
Floor sweepings, new meaning of floor sweepings.
Totally. I mean, you could have done a handstand and snorted it or something. But yeah, so we went on tour. My band, The Screaming Sirens, a lot. Tell me some of your best TSOL stories, and then I'll tell you a couple of mine.
Oh man, well, I toured a lot. I did a lot of tours with TSOL. I bought three or four tours with them, and it was pretty rough tours in a lot of ways because we all jump in the van. We just play shows one after another. One of the roughest things was me and Chris were had to stay with the van in Eudora, Arkansas for 4 days. The van broke down. We were playing in Baton Rouge, and we got the local guy, the only guy that didn't have a pickup truck, the guy that had a van to drive the band to the next show, and the gas wasn't getting to the carburetor, and so we were like sitting in this redneck's truck stop who was a mechanic. We're asking to fix it. And it took him 4 days to fix it. Well, of course, he took Sunday off because he was religious and he, you know, would go have Sunday dinner and he couldn't work on Sunday. We're like, you fucking kidding me? And he comes back Monday and fixes and gets out of there. But like we and Chris were stuck in Eudora for 4 days, drinking beer, talking to the locals, you know, hanging out. It was like unbelievable. You know, those cadacs and the what are those, what are those bugs in the making all that noise, it's like,
oh,
like locusts, the cicadas. Yeah. You know, and it just felt lonely. It's like it was like quiet at night. It was like freaked out. We literally like sleeping in the van and sitting on the front porch of the gas station, and the cop would drive by and wave at us. We'd have a case of beer and be just sitting there drinking. It was like, we're locals now, we live here. People would drive over and go, you're the punk rockers? Yeah, we're the punk rockers. Yeah, that's us. It was unbelievable, you know. Especially because Ron and Roach are like such good friends of mine, was really more like family than a lot of other bands for me. I mean, it was like driving across country for, you know, six times with your best friends. We just hang out and have a really good time. So man, so it was good. It was really good.
Yeah, we used to, my band's first album was called Fiesta. And then that was right around when we started touring with TSOL. It wasn't like all cross country, but we would go to different, you know, we'd go to like Arizona or to, you know, Las Vegas or, you know, just, it was, or Northern California. So we started, because the album was called Fiesta, we started calling them TSOL. and then the first time that we were gonna go on tour with them, we loved them as a band, but I don't know why, I guess because we partied so hard, we were like afraid they were gonna be boring. And so then when we got to Buena Park to Skate Master Tate Jerry Hurtado's house, where everyone was meeting, and then Someone from TSOL said that we should all like switch members, and some should go with TSOL and some should go with the Screaming Sirens. So I wound up in Chris Grayson's station wagon with Mitch and Mike Roach and my drummer Boom Boom. And it was really quiet at first, and just like not even the radio was on. And Boom Boom was like nudging me like, fuck, we picked the wrong vehicle. Like, it's gonna be so stupid. But then it was also Freddie. Well, I can't remember Freddie's last name, but
yeah, I know Freddie. Yeah,
Freddie for anybody listening. Freddie was not famous, but he was infamous. And and we used to call him Freddie Wild. Now that was his nickname that we like our mafia like nickname that we gave him. Anyway, so not even the radio was on. It was really quiet, and Boom Boom and I were all horrified that we were in the Dell van. And suddenly, like, Freddie's like, all right, we're about to get on the freeway. And he pulls out this giant bottle of Jack Daniels. And then he had a giant, huge baggie of Coke and starts just, like, pouring it on the back of his hand and shoving it into the back seat. And then me and Boom Boom just looked at each other and were like, okay, we took the right vehicle. then they taught us about, you have to tell me if you did this with TSOL. They taught us about Ride Till You Break. Did you guys do that?
What's
okay,
that?
You're looking blank. Okay, Ride Till You Break was, this was Chris and Mitch saying Ride Till You Break. Ride Till You Break is when you turn the heater up all the way. And I mean, this was summer anyway, right?
Yeah.
Right? You turn the heater up all the way, you roll up all the windows, and everybody has to smoke a cigarette, even if they don't smoke. And the first person to complain loses.
Nice.
Not any real prize, but we started playing that.
Put the new meaning to secondhand smoke.
Let's have a little break and we'll be right back.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
And then, so we were going to Las Vegas that time, and it was so fucking horrifying. It was our rhythm guitarist's birthday, and she was having what she called the kissing competition, and we were staying in these two shitty motel rooms, like right near wherever, you know, on the outskirts of town, wherever the gig was at the VFW mm-hmm. hall. And so both the doors were open, and everyone was going back and forth, and there was like tons of like, you know, marijuana just laying around on the you know, top of the dresser, which was insanely illegal in Las Vegas. Freddie had gotten arrested earlier for dancing on top of a roulette table, so he was in jail. We were all like wasted as fuck, and then we were just totally oblivious because we were so high. And then suddenly the cops came in, and they were, and then all of a sudden, like they're like, oh, you know, like they made a beeline for the pot on the dresser, and then Marsky, you know, whose birthday it was so fucking wasted. She'd already been making out with like every member of TSOL and their manager, Mike, you know, just saying, this is the kissing competition. I started it at the club. And so they're like, who's this, the marijuana? And we're all looking around like, and Marsky just like walked sideways up to the cop. She was so high. And she's like, dude, it's my birthday. Would you like to join the kissing competition? Cops just like looked at each other. And then she just climbed on him like an orangutan and started making out with him.
And whoa.
Then, yeah. And then he's like, I'm going to take this away and you guys keep the noise down. And they just left.
Nice.
Yeah. That was like perks of being with all girls. But yeah, that right. trip, that trip with TSOL was so fucking insane. Even and after that Mike Rainey started managing us. I don't know why. Yes. Maybe because of the kissing competition.
Sounds about right. Yeah. Sounds about right.
But so well, what about you were gonna start to tell me about touring with Flipper.
Well, Flipper was rough, you know, because I aforementioned a drug problem of two different drugs at one time. We all sat in this bread truck that only went 65 miles an hour. It's like you're like crawling across America, and whoever put the tour together was put like, you know, it was like San Francisco, LA, Denver. You know, so it'd be like, oh, these, yeah. like the jumps, like, you know, and you got to get to Denver overnight, or basically you got to drive. You just got to drive 24 hours straight to get there. And it's like things like that. And then it's also the grueling part of it was a 3 month tour. We were on tour for 3 months. And we went out to New York and stayed at a friend's apartment there, like that'd be our headquarters. And then we'd go up and down the coast and come back to New York. And halfway through the tour, two thirds through the tour, Bruce just quit. Who was the Bruce and Will split the bass playing, lead singing. And so Bruce just quit and left. We had to get DeMartis out. We flew DeMartis out. He was in a band called the Slug Lords. We flew him out there in like Atlanta or Nashville or someplace like that. We get in there. And it was just bizarre, you know. And on top of all, the Flipper didn't really get along. They didn't get along at all. It was always bickering, bitching, yelling. You know, it was like for them and me. It was like I was the one that had to take it all on. I was a road manager, and you know, it just I'd make peace with everybody. It was just a really rough tour, man. I was like I sort of knew it the minute I got in the van with them. I'm like, oh fuck, this is gonna be hard. And Ted Falcone, who I love Ted to death. He's a guitar player. He's awesome. But you know, he was in the army a million years ago. You know, he sort of got this iron rule: you can't do things. You know, I couldn't wear a Walkman. That's how long ago. Wear a Walkman while driving because I'm listening to music because I might not be able to hear if the engine blows up. I'm going, really? You know, I need to hear if the engine blows up, because if the engine blows up, we're pretty much fucked. You know, and shit like that. It was just insane. But you know, it was weird. The weirdest thing happening with them, I think it was them, but maybe not. Is the apartment we shared, it was Denise Sandanko's apartment, was in the Lower East Side. It was across the street from the Hell's Angel building. And Third Street, I think. Was it third? You're probably right. And anyway, I was in there, and I came up upstairs. I was going to get a cup of coffee, you know, and it was really early, and I was strung and wasted. And I came upstairs and I walked out of the, you know, front door of the apartment building across the street, and the whole street was full of DEA agents and ATF and FBI and New York City cops, and they were raiding the Hell's Angel building. And I stepped out, and you know, and like, you know, punk rock clothes, not that far from what the Hell's Angels were wearing, except I'm not wearing colors. I had a cut off black t-shirt, I had black jeans, I had motorcycle boots. And I walked outside, I turned, and there was like all these cops, they all turned and looked at me. I was like, and I just sort of back in the building, you know, just sort of left. And I guess they went over there and raided it and busted them all. But it was totally insane. Yeah, it was totally insane. You know, like, this is weird.
Wow, that's crazy. Let's hear some Flipper. Okay, here we are back again. So where, like, when you were touring, what was like, aside from like drug scoring, what was like one of the funnest places you played, or not dangerous, or, you know, like where did you always have the best times on the road?
Well, I mean, yeah, some, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times it just had to do with where it could score drugs. But besides the fact that, you know, the Kennedys would play little tiny small towns with, and you know, we used to call them turd town tours, because we play like little shithole towns, you know, not too little, but, you know, like not many bands, you know, play Eudora, Arkansas, or something like that, you know, not the way we played there. But we play like smaller towns like Morris, Pennsylvania, and things like that, and all these kids would come out, you know, and that was really cool, because it was like they wanted the show, you know. There wasn't a bunch of skinheads who come out and try and kill you. There was like all these kids who never saw shows, who, you know, were like little punk rockers in their at home and listening to on, you know, radio or tape cassettes or whatever the hell it was, and we do that. We didn't show Regina, Canada, Alberta, Canada, wherever that is, Regina, Canada. And it was just snow. It was 10 feet of snow. It was crazy. And they had this big Quonset hut, and they turned the heat on so that the amps would work. And all this, like, I'm going, no one's coming. We're in the middle of fucking nowhere. The city's got like 20 people in it. You know, it was like just crazy. And 7:30 that night, like, you know, 3,000-4,000 kids showed up.
Wow.
It was just insane. It was amazing. It was totally amazing. It was really cool. And I was like, so that's the stuff I really like. I like playing, like, you know, where people really wanted to see the band, you know. And big cities, everybody's jaded. Everybody's like, fuck, yeah, I've seen the Kennedys. Yeah, I've seen Flipper, whatever. You know, but these kids had never seen shit, and they want to come out and see it. And they bought a ton of T-shirts. They did all this stuff. So those were always fun. Those were always a good time. You know, I wasn't breaking up fights. I wasn't getting in the hassle with a promoter. I wasn't dealing with that kind of shit. I was dealing with people that generally like to see us. that was totally different.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally cool. Like, always when we got back to LA, my bassist Laura used to say, because people would come and see us when we came off the tour, but the tours were always so much fun, and it was always that kind of a reaction, like you said. We'd go on stage and there'd just be people standing there, and then after like the fourth or fifth time that happened, Laura said, you know, the thing I don't like about LA is that everyone who comes to see your shows is in a band that's just a little bit better than yours, because that's what they acted like, you know what I mean?
And then, right,
you'd have been playing like with you guys or with like my band or something, it would be like, you know, 3 weeks or 6 weeks of just like insane, amazing shows with fun people and just great times and stuff. I mean,
yeah,
from like, you know, the breakdowns or the occasional border arrests.
Right.
So like, so how long kind of was your whole road career? You don't still do that anymore, right?
No, I stopped doing that. I, you know, my career ended just because of drug addiction. But it was a good 6 years, 7 years. And I started out really early. I was fumbling on the timeline earlier. But 81, I started. And the last few shows I did were 87, 88. That's what sort of ended. So it was a long run. In tour life, like just like dog life, that's a long, run.
Yeah, that's, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, I evolved from being, you know, like a roadie into like head of the road crew, into road manager and things like that, just sort of advanced up there. And so the next kind of thing is then, you know, going into, you know, band management. I didn't really want to do that, you know. I had enough of those people on the road. You know, I was like, okay, we're good. We can separate now. I never see you again for another 2 months, something like that. Because, you know, I love most people in bands I work with. But, you know, when you're really in close quarters and you're with somebody like that, you sort of, you know, it gets a little tiring.
Yeah. When did you start writing? Were you already writing like before? Or were you keeping diaries like while you were on tour or anything, or just?
No, I didn't keep any diaries on tour. Like it wasn't even in that kind of realm, you know. And you know, unfortunately, I didn't keep a lot of documentation. I didn't take a lot of pictures, you know. I didn't do a lot of stuff, which is sad because it, you know, punk rock was so immediate. All that stuff's gone. We know that there's no history of it. My writing took off from a total different angle. Was that my addiction took over. And I went from, from 17-year-old getting involved with punk rock to 20 years later, being a dope fiend. And the only thing punk rock about me is I got a leather jacket. And what I'm doing is I'm living in some pretty shitty parts of San Francisco. And I started doing holdups to pay for my my addiction. And what happened is I escalated from, stupid gas station type things, like, convenience stores, where the hell I'm doing, to bank robbery. And I started robbing banks for a few years and got nailed and busted on that, fought a court case, so on and so forth, and finally got convicted and did time in San Quentin. But while I was in county jail, I went to an adult education class. I had a serial killer for a cellie. And so I was locked in the cell for 23.
Was anyone famous?
No, he was in San Francisco. He's famous, called the Digitalis, because him and his girlfriend would feed Digitalis to these, the plant to these old men who they had signed over their stuff, and these old men would die and leave them their houses and stuff like that.
Wow, that's fun.
But after the fourth guy, they're kind of like, this looks a little suspicious here. Now you own five houses, that kind of thing. But that was my cellie. He would do things like, hey, you want some candy? And I'm like, hell no, I don't want anything from you, man. But they offered adult education classes in county jail in San Francisco, at least back then they did. And I went to a creative writing class, and I dug it. I really dug it. It was kind of cool. I wrote like about all the people I used to hang out with and crimes I pulled and stuff like that. And then when I got convicted, went to San Quentin, there was a writing club there too, and I got involved with those guys. And they were serious writers, and they're really good. And I got a lot of really good reactions from that. And I sort of considered myself a writer, but I wasn't really, wasn't sure. And when I got on parole, I got a blog, and this is again how old it was. A blog. I got a blog on the internet, and I started writing like 1,000 word pieces every week and publishing them. I got a really good response from that too. And about 6 years after all that, I went back to school and I got my master's degree in creative writing at Antioch University, Los Angeles. And that's when I sort of considered myself to be a writer. I don't know if I need a piece of paper to do that, but I got recognition for it. And my thesis became my first book. So that's the whole evolution of my writing career.
Your writing is great. So tell our listeners about like a typical bank robbery, or like how innovative you got with your robberies.
Well, originally there was three of us. There was me and another guy that would go in, and a kid that drove for us, and we would sit out front. We'd watch things, and we'd see when it was crowded, when it wasn't crowded. We'd see when the bank truck came up, picked up all the money. We'd sort of watch for a while. And then we decided a time that was less busy. We always decided, we definitely wanted a bank where there wasn't a security guard with a gun inside and all these other things. And so me and my friend would go in, and what we started doing was going in disguises. We'd wear suits and fake mustaches and wigs. I had a baseball cap with a fake ponytail out the back of it. One time we went in dressed as we had a motorcycle leather gear and helmets. We ran in and did the thing, ran out and jumped in the car, thinking for sure the cops would think we were leaving on a motorcycle. And so did those kind of things. It's quick. I mean, you have a you're like 90 seconds to get in and get out. You kind of get in there. That's once you start the bank robbery. You go stand in line. Once you hit the teller, you show them the gun, and there's no notes involved. You just go, here's the gun, and they open the cash register. Somebody somewhere is pulling an alarm in that building. And so you got to get the register. You got to get money out of the register, and you got to get the fuck out of there. So that's basically what it was. And it was just trying to be innovative. The thing was, when we first started robbing banks, we just dressed like we normally dress. We dressed like punk rock. We go and cut off t-shirts,
right,
not exactly like. And the San Francisco Chronicle was publishing, because we got pretty notorious because we were hitting them all the time, was publishing articles about us, and they said, call us the Men in Black, That's what they called us, okay? Because they always call you something. The Roberts, the Men in Black. So there's two of us, we'd be in black. And I started cutting those articles out for the newspapers and taped them up in my kitchen wall. You know, like it was like, you know, reviews of our work or something like that. And when the cops came and they kicked in my door, they just walked in the kitchen and, oh man, you gotta be kidding me. These people are stupid.
They saw that? I mean, that was all over. Oh my God, that's so sick. Look, I'm famous.
Famous in my own mind. It was hilarious.
Oh my God. So, wow. Like, I don't even know what to ask now. Well, I know. Was there surveillance in the banks? Was there like surveillance cameras at that point when you were doing?
Yeah, there were surveillance cameras, but they were looking. They looked down on you. To make sure
the teller wasn't stealing.
Yeah, like the weird things like that. But all, you know, they were just surveillance cameras all up high, so you don't really notice them. And when I was at 850 Bryant, which is the cop shop in San Francisco, and that's right after they busted me, the feds came in, and the feds were going to pick up the case because it was, you know, because it was bank robberies, and the state of California said, no, don't do that. We're gonna three strike them. We're gonna you know, give them three strikes and put them away for life, and which is a bastardization of the law because they're just gonna go 1, 2, 3 and then put me away. The feds pulled out a notebook full of glossy photos, stills from the surveillance cameras. And I saw a bunch of me in there. There's a bunch of pictures. There was a bunch of other bank robbers, like, you know, guys in trench coats with AK-47s and all stuff like that. I'm like, wow, they're pretty into it. But then there'd be like this weird shot of me from the top with my ponytail, my fake ponytail, and my little baseball cap, my business suit, or the fake mustache. And I go, ooh, you know, they're like, you see anybody you recognize? Like, nope. Don't see anybody in there.
How'd they know that? Wait, were they just showing you random photos, or did they know that that was you?
They knew that was me. They totally knew it was me. You know, they totally figured out. They what they're trying to say in their you know, inept sort of way was, we got you, we totally got you. You know, and what they wanted me to do was go, oh, that's me. Look, that's me, and totally admit it. You know, the woman FBI, she walks in, looks at me, goes, you're not a bank robber. And I was like, okay, good. You know, but she wanted me to go, oh yeah, bitch, yeah, I'm a bank robber. You know, they play these mind games with you. But you're not a bank robber. I went, cool. I'm not a bank robber.
Oh my God.
Fucking cops.
Wow. I'm sorry. This could go on for ages. So, I mean, when you're looking back on all of this, like, what goes through your mind?
Well, I mean, you know, it's the, like I talked about earlier, it was so, you know, live fast, die young. And there's a whole lot of people that aren't in my life anymore. It's pretty hard to deal with, you know, the fact that none of it was really documented. You know, I want to put those people down on paper so that they are known. So that it's a piece of history, you know, and, you know, all of us did this thing. And now we're doing something else. And now we're, like, you know, living our lives, this other thing like that. And it's almost like it's so undocumented. It's almost like it didn't happen in a lot of ways. You know, and if you weren't one of the big bands that really totally made it, you were like the behind the scenes person like I was, you know, kind of like that. It's like I just want to, you know, put our piece of history in there, you know, talk about us, talk about what we did. And talk about all the people, and you know, and there's an acknowledgement in the back of my book, and half the names in there got RIP behind them.
Yeah,
you know, and those were like amazing people, you know, and you know, they had brilliant lives. You know, one of my best friends was Will Shatter. He was with Flipper, and you know, he died really young and drug overdose. And you know, that guy was larger than life. I thought he'd be my friend. We'd be together and just friends for the rest of our lives. And it was cut short. You know, Chris Grayson was murdered in a drug deal.
Yeah.
You know, all these things happened, you know, and you know, the way the world is that they have their place in history. Like what people remember that, but it's not going to get passed down. That's not a story that's going to go to somebody else. You know, unfortunately, Chris won't, you know, no one but us is going to remember Chris. You know, it's not going to be like he was a memorialized in anything, you know. Will Shatter has this place, like they, people, you know his music, but you know, Flipper's an obscure band, you know. And I wanted to really put these people down, and that's what, so you know, and also I really wanted to work through my shit with the stuff. You know, it's like I've had to, you know, grapple with who I am. If I'm not a drug addict, I'm not in the music industry, if I'm not on the road, you know, I need to come to peace with my history too, you know, and that's what a lot of my writing was about there.
Yeah. I mean, your writing is so good. It's so immediate. It really like can pull whoever's reading it just right into whatever you're doing. I love that. And, you know, I always, if I'm ever reading like a, you know, punk rock sort of book or something, there's always people in it that I know, you know.
Yeah.
And so I always have to walk that little line, like, is this a great book or do I just like it? My friends.
Right.
But yours is just so good. You're such a great writer.
Thank you.
So tell anybody if you've got stuff, like if you're doing any virtual events or any kind of live stuff that you know of, or you know, like you guys can always follow him on social media, and that'll be in the episode description.
But yeah, or you go to my website, which is Patrick patrick-oneil.com. It has all that stuff in it too. I'm doing a reading in Echo Park for Rorschach on the, I forget what it is, 31st or something like that, coming up.
31st of July or August?
July. We're coming up on July.
Wait, I feel like I'm on the road. What month is it? No.
Exactly how I feel. Like where you know, and then I'll have more stuff coming up. I'm gonna have a book release party. I'm gonna do some stuff. I just been sort of slacking all my things. The book came out and I just sort of been slacking. Book came out in May. It's weird. It's weird having stuff in COVID. It's a lot different. You know, like will people come, will people not come? I don't necessarily want to do a virtual event, you know, but I don't want my book release to be the super spreader event. That motherfucker got me COVID. You know, I don't want one of those things. I remember him, he got me COVID. You know,
went from bank robbing to super spreading.
Right, exactly. I got a trilogy of novels coming out. I've written the first two already, and they're a noir crime novel set in LA. It's called LA County is the first one, and that should be coming out soon. And, you know, I just stay tuned. There's a bunch of stuff coming out, especially around this book.
Yay, that's good. All right. So you guys, that was Patrick O'Neil, and we could have stayed on probably for like another hour or so, but my podcast isn't that long. But definitely find him, read this book. This book is incredible. If you have any interest in rock and roll or punk rock, this is such a good behind the scenes story about it. You know, like about how the other half was living.
Right.
Anyway, thank you for coming on, Patrick.
Thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah, it's been great. Okay, take care. And I hope next time I see you, you're wearing a baseball cap with a ponytail attached. All right, goodbye.
Bye.
The Devil's Music is written and hosted by Pleasant Gaiman. Produced by Aaron Alden. All sound design by Jerry Danielson of Busy Signal Studios. And of course, is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at pantheonpodcasts.com. Our social presence is at Pantheon Podcasts on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found wherever you get great music. please pick up these important and fantastic tracks. It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.